schmeiß weg, lass es sein, lass es sein. Alles, was ich nerv, mach kaputt, kurz und klein. Ja, ja, ja.
Ja, ja. Ja, ja.
Wo geht's lang mit der Punche dann?
Ja, ja.
Voll im Block, kein Bock oder doch?
Ja, ja.
Die Linken bleiben erst mal sehen, wird schon gehen, wird schon gehen, wird schon gehen.
Ja, ja.
Immer ran, gleich ran, gleich ran, gleich ran.
This is Billy Brandt with Grievous Angel, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Hey, this is Kyle from Three-Legged Fox. You're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves.
Issued a disaster declaration for his state. Parts of...
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, an amazing and sustainable fish farm off the coast of Hawaii. And a spectacular time for sky watchers to catch the crimson planet Mars. Here's a scientist soundbite.
When the sun goes down, you'll see Mars very low in the east. But then as Earth spins on its axis throughout the night, our spin toward the east is going to cause Mars to move westward across our sky.
That's sky watcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
Coyotes and gray wolves were once more similar in size, but when the last ice age ended more than 10,000 years ago and many large species of mammals went extinct, coyotes changed from large, pack-hunting dogs to the smaller canines we know today. The change in size was due to food scarcity, according to a study published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in February.
The U.S. Midwest has been hard hit by a line of tornadoes that took lives and destroyed property overnight on February 28th. At least 9 people were killed and parts of several towns were flattened. That's according to local officials. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback issued a disaster declaration for his state, parts of which were without power. Harrisburg, Illinois was the hardest hit. 6 deaths were reported there, along with nearly 100 injuries and at least 200 homes destroyed or damaged by the tornadoes.
Bioethanol, converted from energy crops, has considerable potential for rendering our society more sustainable, according to a life cycle assessment that compared growing crops for fuel as opposed to refining and using fossil fuels. Bioethanol is an alcohol made by fermentation, mostly from carbohydrates produced in sugar or starch crops, such as corn, sugar beets, or sugar cane. The Japanese study was published in the International Journal of Foresight and Innovation Policy in February.
Researchers in the Netherlands have published a study showing the true cost of animal products globally, but from a water perspective. The study was published online on January 24th in the journal Ecosystems. It shows that increased global meat production is a potentially major environmental problem. That's because raising animals requires a lot more water than growing plant products of equal nutritional value.
In late January 2012, an intense solar storm made a lot of news, but it also provided scientists an opportunity to study the dangers facing astronauts on long-term space flights. The storm hit the new Mars rover Curiosity, currently en route to Mars. And the rover took data on the storm, allowing scientists to increase their understanding of how radiation in space will affect future astronauts. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard.
This week's Song of the Week is Loving Man by the band Burgess Meredith.
Not a crime, let loose, move around and play fool.
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about news of the global night sky and a great time to see planet Mars. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. The planet Mars has a cycle where we only see it at its best every other year. So in 2011, we didn't get a very good view of Mars, but 2012 is going to be, especially March of 2012, is going to be a great time to see the planet Mars.
Wait, so you're telling me that we're going to be able to see Mars even better than we have in the previous months? I believe that we've been able to see like all four planets out, and you're saying now that Mars is even going to appear even brighter.
Well, as Earth moves around the sun and as the other planets move around the sun, the brightness of the planets in our sky waxes and wanes. And so what's happening is that Earth is going to pass between the sun and Mars on March 3rd. So by the time you hear this, that may already have happened. But when that happens, you can see that Earth is passing between the sun and Mars. So Earth and Mars are particularly close to each other around that time. And as a result, the planet Mars appears at its brightest in our sky.
What does that look like? What does Mars look like during this opposition?
Well, and you called it by the right word. It is an opposition because when Earth goes between the sun and Mars, the sun is on one side of us and Mars is on the other side of us. So if you can imagine standing outside on Earth at sunset while the sun is setting in the west, Mars is rising in the east. They're opposite each other in the sky. So that's what's happening in the month of March. When the sun goes down, you'll see Mars rising up in the east. And it looks like a star, but it's very, very bright as stars go, especially during the month of March 2012. And also Mars is very noteworthy for its color. People call it the red planet, and indeed it does look red in the night sky.
A question here. Is it low in the sky? Is it high in the sky? What's happening with Mars?
Well, when the sun goes down, you'll see Mars very low in the east. But then as Earth spins on its axis throughout the night, our spin toward the east is going to cause Mars to move westward across our sky. So it'll be highest in the sky around the middle of the night, you know, depending on where you are on Earth. Could be over your head, or it could be a little lower than overhead. Could be more toward the north or more toward the south, but highest in the sky around midnight, and then setting more or less around dawn. Setting in the west, just as the sun does.
Are there any more tips for people to find planet Mars? And can anybody on Earth see this?
Anybody on Earth can see it. And my advice is to go outside after sunset and stand with your back to the direction of sunset. So your back is to the west and you're facing east. And you're just looking for any very bright reddish object that's appearing over that eastern horizon. And that will be the planet Mars. It'll be the brightest thing over there.
Awesome. And not only sky watchers are interested in Mars this March, but scientists as well. There's a space probe on its way to Mars right now.
That's right. The Mars Science Laboratory was launched in November 2011, and it'll arrive at Mars in August of 2012. And it's carrying a new rover to Mars. And there are a couple of rovers on Mars right now. One of them is not operating, but the other one has been, you know, long past its expected operating lifespan, so it's still going on Mars. But this new Mars rover, which is called the Curiosity rover, will be getting to Mars in August of 2012. And it's going to do some better things, some interesting things on Mars. Of course, with Mars, what we're always doing there is looking for signs that there may have been life on the planet in the past, or even that there may be some forms of life in the Martian soil even now.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's going to be amazing when it gets there, when it reaches the surface of Mars. Right now, it's on its way. And just recently, there was news on EarthSky.org about a powerful solar storm that that bathed this Curiosity rover in solar particles.
That's right. That was a cool thing that happened as the Curiosity rover has been en route to Mars. And in January of 2012, of course, the sun right now is in a very active phase. So we've been seeing lots of solar storms and flares and radiation storms coming our way, even from Earth. Of course, we're protected here on Earth by our atmosphere, so we don't have to fear those solar storms. But out in space, there is no atmosphere. So here's the Mars rover cruising along on its way to Mars. And on January 22nd of 2012, a solar storm, a very powerful solar storm. In fact, NASA called it the most powerful solar storm since 2005, erupted on the surface of the sun and sent a cloud of radiation particles hurtling through space squarely at this Mars rover. And it hit the Mars rover dead on. And you know, people thought, wow, that, you know, that's an interesting thing to happen. But in fact, space scientists had prepared for something like that. I mean, they knew when they launched the Mars rover that the sun was going to be in an active phase. And in fact, the Mars rover is carrying an instrument that is designed specifically to measure these solar particles, this radiation from the sun, which indeed would be dangerous to astronauts if they, instead of a robot spacecraft going along in space, the Mars rover being carried there by the spacecraft, if there had been human astronauts inside that spaceship, you know, this radiation storm would have been damaging to their bodies. And so this Mars rover in January was able to measure the radiation storm from space and get some data on this type of storm that will be useful when someday people go to Mars.
I know solar storms, they're dangerous for astronauts, dangerous for space tourists, but they make really beautiful aurora in our atmosphere.
That's right. Yeah, they're not dangerous at all for us on Earth's surface. They can affect our technology, but they don't affect our human bodies in a negative way. We're protected by the atmosphere. But they do make these beautiful auroras or northern lights that people at northerly latitudes have been seeing a lot in the past year and will continue to see as the sun reaches the peak of its cycle in the year 2013.
And if you can't see, if by chance you do catch an aurora, that's fantastic. But everyone on planet Earth will be able to see the planet Mars coming up in March.
That's right. So as this little robot explorer is making its way to Mars here over the coming months, you can stand on Earth and think about that spacecraft. Like, you can actually look at the sky and see that very bright red planet Mars ascending in the east in the evening, and imagine that little invisible robot spacecraft that's on its way between Earth and Mars, even as you gaze at Mars.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky, we interview the world's top scientists. The demand for quality seafood continues to grow worldwide. A consequence of that is overfishing, which has depleted 70% of the world's fisheries. Some fishers are coming up with innovative ideas to make fish farms sustainable with minimal impact, like pollution, on the environment. A great example of that is the Valella Project in Hawaii by Kampachi Farms. This aquaculture company raises kampachi, a sushi-grade yellowtail fish, to market size in drifting spherical pens that freely move with currents and winds in water over 2 miles deep and up to 150 miles away from the Hawaiian coast. Here to talk more about it is marine biologist Neil Sims. Mr. Sims, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jorge. It's a real pleasure to be here indeed.
Now, what is open ocean aquaculture?
Open ocean aquaculture is the culture of fish and bivalves and algae, all that great seafood that's so good for us. But it's culturing these animals and these plants in more exposed open water, what we like to say is deeper water further offshore. And the advantages of doing this are that you minimize the potential for environmental impact, and you minimize the potential conflict with other user groups of the ocean. And so this then allows us to scale. If we are going to have a planet with 9 billion people on it by 2050, then we need to massively increase the amount of seafood that we produce.
Mr. Sinsom, tell us about your involvement in open ocean aquaculture
And one of these projects that you've been involved with, the Vilela Project.
I was involved as the co-founder of Kona Blue Water Farms, which was the first integrated marine fish hatchery and open ocean mariculture site located here in Kona, Hawaii. And Kona Blue Water Farms had really pioneered the production of sashimi-grade fish from an open ocean mariculture site. And we have been focusing now in our new company, Kampachi Farms, we've been focusing on the global growth of the production of open ocean seafood. And we've been focusing on the next generation technologies for open ocean mariculture. And we are focused on finding ways that we can actually commercialize this technology in what we're thinking of more as a regional drifter pen. And so this would be a net pen that would not be anchored to the bottom, but that would drift around in the eddies that are, for example, around the back of the Big Island of Hawaii as the equatorial current flows from one side of the ocean, from east to west across the Pacific Ocean. We've had the Vilela Project launched since May of 2011, and we have just completed the harvest of the first cohort of fish from the Vilela Project. The fish that we cultured in there were the Kampachi, which is an amberjack or a yellowtail. It's closely related to the Japanese hamachi, so it's a real sashimi-grade fish, very high-value fish. It's native to the waters of Hawaii. We're able to produce them in the hatchery, in a land-based hatchery system, and then move them out into the Vilela pen. The fish growth was phenomenal in this open ocean location. The fish health and the feed conversion ratio also were very good. The survival was really good. So we think that there's some tremendous advantages that we didn't expect here, that we're seeing some physiological response from the fish to being grown in these conditions here.
The Obamas reportedly have eaten Kampachi, raised by Kona Blue Water Farms. Why do you think they chose your fish?
It was served to them by a private chef who knew of our fish and had approached us and said that he'd like to try it prior to serving it to the Obamas. We sent him across a couple of samples and he came back to us just effusively positive. He said the words were that he was just blown away by the quality of this fish. And so he was very proud to be able to serve this locally grown fish to the Obamas when they were here in Hawaii. And we were very proud ourselves to have grown fish that the president ate. There is increasing recognition by the federal government that we need to move forward with open ocean mariculture. And NOAA has recently, in the last year, come out with an aquaculture policy that affirms that this really is something that America needs to lead on. I'm tremendously pleased to see that. This leadership role is something that the US plays in so many other industries, yet up to now in aquaculture, we've very much played the back seat. We import over 85% of the seafood that is consumed in the US, and over half of that imported seafood is farmed. Yet as we become increasingly reliant on new technologies to produce the seafood that we want to eat, this is something that we really should be doing here in the U.S.
You've been listening to marine biologist Neil Sims of Kampachi Farms, speaking to us from a studio in Kona, Hawaii. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Byrd. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Burgess Meredith, Sleep Good, The Black and White Years, 100 Flowers, and Okote Soul Sounds. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists. Too much art and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists with too much heart and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage. But what we don't know won't hurt us.
what we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't end us there.
This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
One man shoots another. He's caught. Normally, we might think that the punishment should depend on how much the killer was to blame. And blame rests on the notion that the man had free will. He had a choice. He could have chosen not to shoot. But according to neuroscientist David Eagleman, the more we understand how the brain works, the more we realize how choices are actually made, the more the notion of free will is undermined. This has radical consequences for how we should think about punishment.
David Eagleman, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Hello, great to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is morality and the brain. In one sense, it's obvious that there's a connection between the two because most of us believe that the brain has a fundamental role in our behavior. But neuroscientists today are making discoveries, it seems to me, which are changing our fundamental understanding of how we make decisions about the things that matter.
That's right. I mean, I think when we look at morality, we have lots of intuitions about what we might mean, but Mother Nature has been running experiments for thousands of years where people get brain damage, either because of traumatic brain injury or degenerative disorders, things like that. And we can see that morality is something much more fragile than we ever imagined. And after brain damage, people can have completely different kinds of behavior. Morality is not something that is separable from the brain, but instead depends on the integrity of this 3-pound alien computational device inside our skulls.
Could you give an example then of when things go wrong? I mean, a particular example.
Most people know about the example of Phineas Gage, and the reason he's a famous case is because he didn't die. He had a tamping rod go through his head and take away a big part of his frontal cortex, but he lived, and that's why he became a famous case. And then, of course, the result was that his personality changed. We have much more modern examples of that that are in the literature all the time. There was a paper reported just a few years ago of a man who started becoming a pedophile, and he had been married to his wife for a long time, and she knew him. She knew this wasn't like him, but he was collecting child pornography. He then made an inappropriate move on her stepdaughter, and she left the house and pressed charges on him. At the same time, he was complaining of worsening headaches, and at some point, he was able to get to the physician, and they did a brain scan and discovered he had a massive frontal lobe tumor. So the surgeons took the tumor out, and his sexual appetite returned completely to normal. And the strange postscript to the story is that 6 months later, he started becoming a pedophile again, and he went back to the doctors. It turned out the surgeons had missed a part of the tumor, which was regrowing. They took it out a second time, and his behavior returned completely to normal. So when we look at cases like that, which are sort of extreme and clear, and then we even look to things that people do every day, where they spike their brain's chemicals with alcohol or nicotine or drugs of all sorts, they're doing that in order to change themselves and their decision-making and the way they feel and their behavior. And nowadays, when we talk about morality and decision-making, I think we have to talk about the neural basis of it, because what's clear from all of these examples is when the brain changes, you change.
And it's not just that the brain is changing. It's that most of the changes in the brain are fundamentally inaccessible to us.
That's right. There's this massive operating system that's running under the hood. Take the example of lifting your arm. So it seems effortless, but there's this lightning storm of activity that underpins that. The same is true with your senses of what's moral or ethical or the right thing to do in a situation. That gets served up by this lightning storm of electrical activity, and all we ever get is the end result. And it turns out that the conscious mind is really the smallest bit of what's happening in the brain, and most of the stuff just gets fed up to you as an intuition about what's right or wrong.
So we've got the case of a paedophile who has a detectable organic cause of his behavior, it seems, that there's a tumor in the brain, there's a direct link between that and his behavior. Also, we've got the ordinary case, the normal brain, where most of what we're doing is inaccessible to us. If you're going to say that the guy with the brain tumor isn't fully culpable, surely you're going to have to say the same sort of thing about ordinary human beings.
So this is the tricky position that the legal system finds itself in. The more we understand about human behavior, the more we understand how people's brains came to be the way they are from a very complicated intertwining of genetics and environment. It turns out that if free will exists, it's really a bit player in what's going on in the brain. And the reason is your genes, which you don't choose, and your environment, including your in utero environment and your whole, all of your childhood experiences, we don't choose that. These are the things that come together and make your brain the way it is and define a lot of your trajectory in life. And if you have free will, it can only modulate something that's already got a lot of momentum and direction in a particular direction. When you look at some criminal who's done something heinous and you say, well, I wouldn't have used my free will to make that decision, your brain and his brain are not comparable. You can't stand in his shoes, neurally speaking, because if you didn't have that set of genes and in utero cocaine poisoning and childhood abuse and lead paint in your home and so on, your brain and his brain just aren't the same. This puts the legal system in this funny situation where we have this increasing understanding that we are inseparably yoked to our biology, including things we did not choose. And the legal system is still asking this question of, well, was it his fault or his biology's fault? And it turns out that that question doesn't make sense anymore. We can't ever separate these things out and say, oh, well, this was not due to your entire biology leading up to this point, but somehow a choice that you independently made of that. So there's only one solution out of this conundrum, which is we need the legal system to be forward-looking. Instead of being backward-looking and asking, can we possibly untangle this crazy network of genes and experience, all it needs to be is forward-looking and say, okay, what do we do with this brain from here? Culpability is the wrong question for the legal system to be asking. It doesn't matter how you got here. If you were abused as a child, that encourages us to come up with social programs to prevent child abuse, but it doesn't allow us to say that you shouldn't be taken off the streets if you're dangerous. So the legal system should be saying, given the brain in front of the bench, what can we do from here in terms of risk assessment, in terms of the probability of recidivism? And the surprising part is there's a lot more power in the numbers, in the statistics, than anyone would have guessed. In other words, when you look at large groups of offenders coming out of prison and you follow them out for years to see who reoffends and who does not, it turns out that some people are quite dangerous, some people aren't so dangerous, and everywhere in between. And there are factors that have some predictive power for this. Now, some people say, well, where's the humanity in bringing science to sentencing? And my answer to that is, compared to what? Compared to the lousy way that we do it now, people who are ugly get longer sentences than people who are good looking. Of course, minorities get much longer sentences than the majority population.
You're talking about calibrating the punishment or treatment to the criminal, the particular criminal's brain.
That's exactly right. So the idea is, as we have a better biological understanding of why people behave the way they do, this isn't going to exculpate anybody, because we still have to take dangerous people off the street. But people break the law for many different reasons. And some people we need to take off for a longer time, others for shorter, and others we can do something to help them. People think that about a third of the incarcerated population has mental illness. Well, that's not the appropriate thing to do with people who are, say, schizophrenic, throw them in prison. What many jurisdictions are doing is they're starting a mental health court system where, if you're mentally ill, people have realized it's both more humane and more cost-effective to root them off on a different path and say, okay, well, we're going to try to help you instead of just putting you in this revolving door of prison. So, yeah, the idea is that the punishment should fit the brain.
Seems to me we've always had a concept of diminished responsibility, but you're not talking about degrees of responsibility. It seems to me that you're saying that nobody is morally responsible for their crimes.
It's not that we have to say nobody's morally responsible, which seems like a provocative statement, but instead we get to redefine what we mean by things. The question of culpability is the wrong question to ask. So remember, there are two phases to a criminal case. There's the fact-finding part where you decide guilt or innocence. Then there's the sentencing phase, and that's where this issue of culpability comes in, where we say, well, was it his fault? How blameworthy is the person? And this is it's the second phase that neuroscience comes in. Obviously, people don't get off of a crime. If they've committed the crime, then they are guilty of it. It's a matter of saying, how can we help? How can we do customized sentencing? What I'm suggesting is asking the question of culpability is simply the wrong question. It doesn't matter, because we're never going to be able to untangle the genes and the environment and everything that's led a person to be the way that they are. There's no suggestion here that somebody with no chance of recidivism will get off scot-free. But I do want to point out that the suggestion I'm making is one that's already embedded in the legal system. So, for example, a crime of passion is treated with much more leniency than a premeditated murder, even though they've both ended up in somebody being dead. Why? Because a crime of passion is understood as something that, depending on the circumstances, has a much lower chance of recidivism in the future, whereas a premeditated murderer tends to be much more dangerous. So it's already the case that we have this in the legal system, and I think appropriately so.
Now, we've been talking about the morality of punishment, but it seems to me that a lot of what you've been discussing would also apply to the morality of praise and celebration of people's achievements. Most of the things that make us capable of doing something successful are, again, outside our control.
You know, I've been thinking a lot lately about the concept of virtue and what we mean by that. The brain is a team of rivals. You have a lot of competing networks, all of which think they know the best way to accomplish something. It's like people in parliament that all love their country but might have very different approaches to things. That's what's happening in the brain. One of the major rivalries that happens in the brain is short-term impulse gratification versus more long-term reasoned decision-making. And these are always locked in battle. If I put a chocolate chip cookie in front of you, part of you wants it, part of you wants to muster the fortitude to forego it. Once we understand issues like that in the brain, and we can use neuroimaging to understand the networks underlying this, what that means is I think we can start getting traction on some of these philosophical issues like virtue. Virtue seems to be when someone has a temptation and overcomes it. If somebody does not have the temptation at all, we don't really think of him as a virtuous person. I think this gives us a new way of approaching the problem about what things we'd like to praise in people.
Someone like Jean-Paul Sartre would say, this is just self-deception. What you're doing is looking for excuses for behavior all the time. The concept of what it is to be a person, which is to be fundamentally free and shaping your own life, just disintegrates so that one model of humanity, the existentialist model, can't live with neuroscience at all.
Well, that's right. Sartre is an example of a very smart person who lived before the blossoming of modern neuroscience. And I think it's very difficult to maintain this illusion that we make all of our own choices when you see brain damage of all sorts. Because when you look at people who have brain damage due to, you know, 50 different things we can name, you see that it changes their capacity for decision making. It alters their ability to understand consequences and simulate possible futures. It changes their risk aversion. It changes the kind of choices they make and the kind of people they are. We have to admit in the end, even though it's uncomfortable sometimes, that what we call choice is absolutely dependent on the integrity of this 3-pound organ in our skulls.
David Eagleman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.
This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
The age of law reform and the age of Jeremy Bentham are one and the same. So said one of Bentham's 19th century contemporaries. Bentham's proposed reforms were designed to increase happiness and minimise pain. That was his overriding aim in everything. He even donated his body to science. His fully dressed skeleton can now be seen in a glass case at University College London. So prolific was Bentham that a project to transcribe and edit his writings has been going on for decades. Philip Schofield has devoted much of his academic life to Bentham. Professor Schofield is both the director of the Bentham Project and editor of Bentham's collected works.
Philip Schofield, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you very much.
The topic we're going to focus on today is Jeremy Bentham's utilitarianism. Could you say a little bit about who Jeremy Bentham was?
Jeremy Bentham was born in 1748. He died in 1832. He lived most of his life here in London. His father, realising that the young Jeremy was very clever and himself being a lawyer, decided that Jeremy would pursue a career in law. Bentham himself, however, decided that he would rather reform the law. So about the age of 21, he set off on what became his lifelong career of writing and thinking about the law.
Now, if you want to go about reforming the law, what do you do?
What he thought you should do was abolish the common law and established a codified system of law. Statute was the way forward rather than the common law, but codified statute. He thought that utilitarianism should provide the basis for a rational system of law. So you start off by saying, well, what actually causes harm to people? And those are the actions you should prevent.
Utilitarianism is generally thought of as the philosophy which focuses on the consequences of actions, stressing the need to maximise pleasure or maximise happiness, minimise suffering. And Bentham is sometimes described as the father of utilitarianism. Is that a correct picture of him?
That is broadly very true. There were other utilitarians in the 18th century, who William Paley I'm thinking of in particular. I think Bentham and Paley would agree to say that happiness is made up of pleasure and absence of pain, and that the right action is that which maximises pleasure and minimises pain. Paley, however, put God in there. It's God's will that we act in such a way as to maximise pleasure and minimise pain, whereas Bentham would not accept a theological basis for ethics. Bentham actually goes for what we might call a naturalistic or a physiological basis for ethics. So with Bentham, he starts off his perhaps most famous work, An Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation, with the phrase, "Nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pleasure and pain." That word nature is wonderfully ambivalent, because a religiously minded person could think, oh, God's created nature and therefore God's behind this. But what Bentham really thought was that it's a human psychology which forms the basis for ethics, and underpinning that psychology is a physiology.
So what you're saying is that Bentham's utilitarianism is an attempt to put ethics on a scientific basis.
That's right, and that's how he saw it. He was very pleased when somebody referred to him as the Newton of legislation, as Newton had sort of sorted out the laws of the physical world, so Bentham was going to sort out the laws of morals and legislation.
Just to get clear what he meant by pleasure, is it simply the physiological enjoyment that he means by pleasure?
I think it is. He talked about pleasure and pain as being real entities, chemical reactions in the body. They consisted ultimately in substance, in stuff. We have a desire to experience pleasure and an aversion to the experience of pain. That's just the fact of nature. And the greater amount of pleasure you experience, then the better it was. And the greater amount of pain you experience, the worse it was. And words like good and evil didn't make any sense whatsoever unless they were understood or cashed out in terms of pleasures and pains.
But what did that mean practically? Could you get pleasure from anything that you wanted to?
Bentham thought that different people would get different amounts of pleasure from different experiences, or what might be a pleasurable experience to one person might be a painful experience to another.
Doesn't that immediately create a problem for anybody trying to reform the law if you don't know generally which things make people feel pleasure because they've got idiosyncratic quirks? How are you going to go about reforming the law?
This is one of the sort of the interesting things about looking at Bentham, is how he deals with, on the one hand, the sort of the subjectivity of pleasures and pains, and on the other hand, the need to organise society in such a way that we all get along. On the one hand, we want to maximise our own pleasure and avoid pains for ourselves, but that's not the right thing to do. The right thing to do is to perform that action which, when you take into account everyone affected by the action, will maximise pleasure and minimise pain. So I could think of an action which would maximise my pleasure but would be bad for society as a whole. So the right action is that which increases the happiness of society as a whole, and that's why I talked about the greatest happiness of the greatest number. Now, of course, that means someone somewhere has to be in a position where they can say what that greatest happiness is.
Just to be clear about this, he didn't have preconceived views about what sort of things were the things that you ought to do to get pleasure from.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the attractive things about Bentham's philosophy. As far as he was concerned, pushpin is as good as poetry. You know, pushpin was a children's game, and if that gave you pleasure, you know, if you like playing snakes and ladders rather than reading Milton, then that's fine. And that brings in the question of taste, because he thought that people who went around talking about good taste, that it was sort of an aristocratic convention. It was a way of the aristocracy maintaining their superiority over the people as a whole. Bentham, particularly in later life, became very committed to political democracy, but in many respects he'd always been an egalitarian.
And his commitment to equality extended far beyond just people. It included any sentient being, and that was a remarkable position to include animals in your calculation of how to act when he was writing in the late 18th century, early 19th century.
That's right, and I think one of the things about Bentham which I find attractive is intellectual honesty. And so, you know, he thought that human beings were motivated by a desire for pleasure and an aversion to pain, and he thought that animals generally were also motivated by a desire for pleasure and an aversion to pain. As he said, the question is not whether animals can reason, but whether they can suffer. He was very supportive of early moves to improve conditions for animals, to stamp out cruelty to animals. He was actually a great animal lover. He said at one time, this probably came from when he was a child, and he threw the cat out of a window. And we're not sure how high up the window was, but he said it was an action which he instantly regretted and regretted for the rest of his life.
Another area where he made a radical contribution was in the area of homosexuality, where since there's no victim, there's no harm being done that causes pain necessarily, there's no problem with consensual relationships between partners.
Once again, he took a very consistent utilitarian approach to sexual morality. As early as the 1780s, he wrote against the criminalisation of homosexuality. The position in 18th century England for homosexuals was extremely difficult, regarded as a crime punishable by death. And Bentham took the view that any form of sexual activity would only be engaged in if people wished to do so, where it was consensual. And so people should be left free to choose whatever sexual activity they engaged in, whether it was partners of the same sex, partners of the same or different species, with one partner, with more than one partner, whatever parts of the body were involved. Typical Bentham, he has a great big long list of the different permutations in which sexual activity could take place, and he says, why is there just one regular mode, that is, sex between a man and a woman within marriage in order to create children? I mean, he was in favour of marriage because he thought that was conducive to happiness overall, but in terms of sexual morality, there wasn't an unnatural mode, as was claimed by what he called religionists.
Now, Bentham's utilitarianism, the style of thinking that he advocated, has many critics, and the kind of attack that they make on him is that it's a trivialisation of human relations to reduce everything to pleasure and pain on this same scale, that actually we should have a much more sophisticated psychology. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
Bentham has a far more subtle psychology than he's often portrayed as having. For instance, he discusses what he calls circumstances influencing sensibility, and he has a list of, well, I think nearly 30 of these, and the way in which different circumstances such as health, just your social position, your religious views, you know, sort of geographical location, your inclinations, if you like, make a difference to the way in which you get pleasure and pain from your experiences. What he would want to maintain is that at bottom, pleasure and pain are what there is, even though they have different, it's been called a sort of different hedonic tinge. It's almost like you play a particular note on piano and you can play the same note on the trumpet. It's the same pitch, but it sounds different. That seems to me a sort of a helpful way of thinking about what Bentham means by the different circumstances influencing sensibility and the different ways in which we experience pleasure and pain. You know, one of the ways in which one might defend Bentham is to say, well, even if the psychology may be too simplistic, it does provide a basis for reform, for practical proposals.
But was it the right basis? His protege, in a way, John Stuart Mill, criticised him for not distinguishing between higher and lower pleasures, the idea that some causes of pleasure, like reading philosophy, had an intrinsically higher moral worth than other sources of pleasure, like the sorts of pleasures open to a pig.
Bentham, in fact, explicitly denied that, obviously writing before John Stuart Mill had come up with the idea, but Bentham says it's about quantity. And he addresses that question and he says, well, if it so happens that studying philosophy is preferable, it's because it produces a greater amount of pleasure. This is where Bentham is more consistent than John Stuart Mill. I always feel that Mill was actually had more in mind Victorian critics of utilitarianism rather than being intellectually sort of coherent and consistent, whereas Bentham cared less about the critics, was much more radical in many respects.
Now, if you're a utilitarian, you measure the worth of your life, I suppose, by the influence that you've had in generating more happiness than would otherwise have been the case, the difference between the world without you and the world with you. Do you think that, on the whole, Bentham has increased the amount of pleasure in the world?
He's increased my pleasure in terms of studying him. One thing I like about Bentham is that his proposals and his ideas often strike you as being extremely worthwhile and sensible. You know, his commitment to representative democracy, his view that punishment should be used for reformation, and then practical proposals like set up a register for births, deaths and marriages, you know, to increase social security in society, the sort of sexual morality we've talked about. I think there are a lot of aspects of Bentham's thought which we ought to take seriously, even if we haven't done so in the past. So, yeah, I think Bentham is a force for good.
If, as you've said, Bentham was such a sane figure, he was so consistent, he had serious proposals for law reform that could make a difference now, why is he so relatively unknown amongst the great philosophers?
That's a very good question, and part of the answer lies in the way in which he's been received. One place to start is in relation to the 19th century edition of Bentham's works, which is very poorly edited and very unattractive to read. And secondly, I think John Stuart Mill has a certain amount to answer for, in that people want to know about utilitarianism and they think, well, we can read Mill and get it very quickly because he's got a nice short essay called Utilitarianism, whereas where do we start with Bentham? John Stuart Mill put Bentham down to an extent in a couple of his earlier essays.
So if Bentham were alive now, where would he be channeling his focus, his passion and his drive for reform, do you think?
I always think of Bentham as sort of first and foremost a legal philosopher. And I think that's where he still would think there was a lot of work to be done. We don't have a codified system of law. The common law is still very powerful. The lawyers are still making lots of money out of the law. I mean, what Bentham wanted was justice to be accessible, so any person could just go to a judge and quickly get their claim sorted out, that it would be cheap, you don't need lawyers involved. His phrase was justice accessible, the law cognoscible. I think that's where he would be still endeavouring to get change.
Philip Schofield, thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.
This Freakonomics Radio podcast is supported by The Can't Miss, a golf training aid employing precision gyroscopes to develop a pure putting stroke when practicing. Designed for touring professionals and elite amateurs, TCM is on the web at thecantmiss.com.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you?
I've been worse.
You have? All right. Okay.
I'm doing all right.
You're doing all right. Grateful. You know why you're doing all right, though? Because Super Tuesday is behind you, man. You don't have to worry about politics
anymore. That is a big part of it. You know how I feel about the presidency.
That's where generally. I was going, because generally you think it's overrated, right?
I do. I believe that the office of the President of the United States, it just matters a lot less than most people think. Now, I will say, when I make this argument, I get hate mail from both sides of the aisle. So conservatives will accuse me of covering for President Obama, and liberals accuse me of kind of preempting criticism of some future Republican nominee.
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, the man is the leader of the free world, so to speak. So what's the actual truth here, dude? How do you feel?
Well, you know, look, personally, I have no horse in any race. I dislike both political parties about equally. But here's the thing. We're heading into a presidential campaign now that is likely to focus on the economy, and rightfully so.
Yep.
And I'm here to tell you and your listeners that of all the areas in which the president's influence is overrated, the economy is probably number one. So I'd like you here to listen to Austin Goolsbee, who's a former chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors.
I think the world vests too much power, certainly in the president, but probably in Washington in general, for its influence on the economy, because most all of the economy has nothing to do with the government.
I love the way he talks, by the way. Sounds like a mafia guy, doesn't he? All right, but wait, listen, you were around in the 92 election. You were paying attention, yes?
I was a sentient being then,
that's
yes.
Right. So Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. That's why the guy won.
It's a fantastic campaign slogan. You get to brag about how you will raise employment and lower gas prices, as if, Kai, there's some magical set of buttons in the Oval Office that you get to push once you're elected. You know, more jobs button and so on. But as Austin Goolsbee points out, the president's ability to actually change the shape and the direction and the velocity of the macroeconomy, it's extremely limited.
Let me go back then to the actual politicians who say otherwise. You had Clinton, and now you've got Mitt Romney, former CEO, a business guy, goes out every stump speech he makes, and he says, I know what to do in the economy. I've been there. I've created jobs. I've fired people, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're not buying that?
I buy that he believes that to be true. A lot of people have believed that to be true in the past. This kind of common idea of the last 10, 15 years is president as CEO. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work that way. We set it up to not work that way. When it comes to unilateral decision making, there's no comparison between what a CEO can do and what a president can try to get done. Here's another way of looking at it, some actual data, okay, which is what we like to do.
I was waiting for the data, man. Come on.
In the 2004 Bush-Kerry presidential election, you may recall that there was a little bit of a snafu concerning the early exit polls.
Oh, yeah. Kerry was the winner for, like, what, 3-something hours, 4 hours?
That's exactly right. It was announced that it was Kerry, but it turned out to be Bush. And the economist Justin Wolfers took advantage of that mix-up for a study that he did.
2004 was a social scientist's dream. What you have is these 4 hours. I'm a Democrat, so I'll say 4 beautiful hours. In which we basically had a Kerry presidency. And it was random.
So what Wolfers did is he looked at how the stock markets reacted to first the news of a Kerry presidency and then the new, turned out to be correct news, of a Bush presidency.
You see, in fact, that stocks fell a little bit during the 4 hours of the Kerry presidency. And then they rose a bit when it became the Bush presidency.
Now, the difference between a new Democratic president and a new Republican president in the space of 4 hours was actually pretty small. It's about 1.5%. Now, this is just a sliver of evidence, but it does suggest that the people who pay the most attention to the working economy, which is to say Wall Street investors, didn't really care all that much about which president they got. And most economists will tell you that the president's role when it comes to the economy is much closer to, let's say, a cheerleader than a CEO.
Well, yeah, but you're never going to see Obama or Romney out there going, I can do nothing. Right?
No, you won't. They've got their self-interest. But just once, I'd love a presidential candidate to get up there on the stump and say, my fellow Americans, I can't control the U.S. economy. I've got a little bit of influence, but mostly it does what it does. If it gets worse on my watch, you shouldn't blame me. And if it happens to get better, you probably shouldn't give me too much credit either.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Stephen Dubner.
I think not. Here.
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, an amazing and sustainable fish farm off the coast of Hawaii. And a spectacular time for sky watchers to catch the crimson planet Mars. Here's a scientist soundbite.
When the sun goes down, you'll see Mars very low in the east. But then as Earth spins on its axis throughout the night...
This Freakonomics radio podcast is supported by The Can't Miss, a golf training aid employing precision gyroscopes to develop a pure putting stroke when practicing. Designed for touring professionals and elite amateurs, TCM is on the web at thecantmiss.com.
The co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you?
I've been worse.
You have? All right. Okay.
I'm doing all right.
You're doing all right. Great. You know why you're doing all right, though? Because Super Tuesday is behind you, man. You don't have to worry about politics anymore.
That is a big part of it. You know how I feel about the presidency.
That's where generally. I was going, because generally you think it's overrated, right?
I do. I believe that the office of the President of the United States, that it just matters a lot less than most people think. Now, I will say, when I make this argument, I get hate mail from both sides of the aisle. So conservatives will accuse me of covering for President Obama, and liberals accuse me of kind of preempting criticism of some future Republican nominee.
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, the man is the leader of the free world, so to speak. So what's the actual truth here, dude? How do you feel?
Well, you know, look, personally, I have no horse in any race. I dislike both political parties about equally. But here's the thing. We're heading into a presidential campaign now that is likely to focus on the economy, and rightfully so.
Yep.
And I'm here to tell you and your listeners that of all the areas in which the president's influence is overrated, the economy is probably number one. So I'd like you here to listen to Austin Goolsbee, who's a former chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors.
I think the world vests too much power, certainly in the president, but probably in Washington in general, for its influence on the economy, because most all of the economy has nothing to do with the government.
I love the way he talks, by the way. Sounds like a mafia guy, doesn't he? All right, but wait, listen, you were around in the 92 election. You were paying attention, yes?
I was a sentient being then,
that's
yes.
That's right. So Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. That's why the guy won.
It's a fantastic campaign slogan. You get to brag about how you will raise employment and lower gas prices, as if, Kai, there's some magical set of buttons in the Oval Office that you get to push once you're elected. You know, more jobs button and so on. But as Austin Goolsbee points out, the president's ability to actually change the shape and the direction and the velocity of the macroeconomy, it's extremely limited.
Let me go back then to the actual politicians who say otherwise. You had Clinton, and now you've got Mitt Romney, former CEO, a business guy, goes out every stump speech he makes, and he says, I know what to do in the economy. I've been there. I've created jobs. I've fired people, blah, blah, blah. You're not buying that?
I buy that he believes that to be true. A lot of people have believed that to be true in the past. This kind of common
this song
idea
says,
of the last 10, 15 years is president as CEO. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work that way. We set it up to not work that way. When it comes to unilateral decision-making, there's no comparison between what a CEO can do and what a president can try to get done. Here's another way of looking at it, some actual data, okay, which is what we like to do.
I was waiting for the data, man. Come on.
In the 2004 Bush-Kerry presidential election, you may recall that there was a little bit of a snafu concerning the early exit polls.
Oh.
4 hours was actually pretty small. It was about 1.5%. Now, this is just a sliver of evidence, but it does suggest that the people who pay the most attention to the working economy, which is to say Wall Street investors, didn't really care all that much about which president they got. And most economists will tell you that the president's role when it comes to the economy is much closer to, let's say, a cheerleader than a CEO.
Well, yeah, but you're never going to see Obama or Romney out there going, I can do nothing. Right?
No, you won't. They've got their self-interest. But just once, I'd love a presidential candidate to get up there on the stump and say, my fellow Americans, I can't control the U.S. economy. I've got a little bit of influence, but mostly it does what it does. If it gets worse on my watch, you shouldn't blame me. And if it happens to get better, you probably shouldn't give me too much credit either.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Stephen Dubner. Freakonomics.
I think not.
The English and World Language Division announces the 37th annual Francis G. Barrett Creative Writing Contest and 17th annual Larry Coulter Poetry Competition. The contest is open to any student currently enrolled at HFCC. $700 in prize money will be divided among the winners. For submission guidelines, check out michiganave.hfcc.com. freakonomics.edu. Or for more information, call 313-845-9716. All script entries are due by March 15th, 2012.
Snickerdoodle, shortbread, fudgy nut bars. How many treats? Snickerdoodle, shortbread, fudgy nut bars. How many treats in the cookie jar? One.
Dad, you're supposed to jump over the rope.
One more time.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 1-877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
When I grow up, I want to be a rock star. Being a rock star is cool.
You get to play really loud.
Could being loud your job?
If your child is sick over and over again, it could be PI, a defect in the immune system that affects millions. Early detection can give children a chance to dream.
Jeffrey Modell Foundation, 25 years of helping children reach for their dreams.